Support for Here and Now comes from BetterHelp, committed to supporting mental health through therapy. Clients are matched with one of 25,000 therapists and can communicate via video, chat, or phone at betterhelp.com/public.
From NPR and WBUR, I'm Robin Young.
I'm Jeremy Hobson. It's Here and Now, and the news today in the business world is that Amazon is pulling the plug on New York City. The online retail giant had promised to build a new headquarters with 25,000 new jobs in Queens in exchange for billions in tax breaks, but local opposition was too much. Robin Farzad is following this story. He's host of Public Radio's Full Disclosure. Hi, Robin.
Hi, Jeremy.
So Amazon said in a statement today that it was clear local politicians would not work with the company to build the relationships required to get this headquarters off the ground. What happened exactly?
Well, step back for a second and think about Jeff Bezos's awful 2019 to begin with. Here's the wealthiest man in the world in the midst of the most expensive divorce in history, and the National Enquirer trying to blackmail him. So then leftists and New York City community organizers are railing against what Bezos thought was the gift of a lifetime. So, of course, you want to dump someone on Valentine's Day.
You say leftists. You're talking about politicians on the left in New York City who didn't want this headquarters in Queens.
Yeah. I mean, Amazon is such a lightning rod. It's a tech mega player valued at something like $800 billion that's still vying for regional tax breaks. And other critics say it's not diverse enough in its hiring. The benefits it pays out are the share of taxes it pays. You think about New York's decrepit subway system. So Amazon and Bezos are naturally targets for activists like, you know, AOC and Bernie Sanders. And they've been outspoken about this.
But people like the Democratic governor of New York, Andrew Cuomo, was absolutely in favor of this headquarters being put in Queens.
Of course. I mean, you see swaths of Queens are still in dereliction. They're old semi-industrial applications. They're brownfields. You can bring a world-class company like this and suddenly say that we are on par with Seattle as HQ2. And it would be a huge trophy if you're running for president or something down the line. But I think he underestimated the vast blowback, especially from people in the progressive part.
Now, just to remind everybody, as if the whole search for a second headquarters didn't get enough attention, Amazon had asked all cities across the country to submit their bids and say, we want Amazon to come in with a second headquarters. They ended up picking two, New York and just outside of Washington, D.C., Crystal City, Virginia. That was big news for those places. Now that they are saying they're not going to put a second headquarters split in New York City, what happens?
Yeah, the company is saying it's going to go ahead and supplement hiring at its many other hubs to kind of cushion the blow of this bombshell announcement today. Northern Virginia, you said Crystal City, it's going to be a huge beneficiary. And you can be sure that all sorts of runners up, you know, everyone from Miami and smaller cities in the Sun Belt are calling up Seattle today to try to get in on more of that.
But what they're saying is that they're not going to do another one. It's going to be Washington or just outside of Washington, and then they'll beef up Nashville.
Right. But if you take the notional amount that would have been done in New York over several years, maybe you can make a case. But like, guys, let me take 5,000 at a time here. Maybe you can kind of spread the love and sprinkle the wealth.
Is it possible that they're going to see the same kind of opposition locally in Virginia that they saw in New York City and that they won't end up putting a second headquarters there?
Not nearly as much opposition down here in Virginia. There is fear over the infrastructure hit, you know, how a region already infamous for its traffic bottlenecks and shortage of affordable starter homes is going to absorb this gift. But I think most other places are desperate for this kind of thing. They're not in a position like New York to be able to have Google and Yahoo and Apple and other places and Wall Street as backups.
Just briefly, Robin, the story driving the markets today is not this Amazon news. It's the fact that retail sales fell 1.2% in December, biggest drop since September of 2009. What's going on there?
I mean, it's unbelievable to think that you have an economy like this, which is near full employment and the stock market doing well, but we are coming off of a period that saw a triple hit of headwinds, partial government shutdown, the stock market's pullback in December, then a stretch of poor weather. So if you're a category like retail that's desperate for good news, you don't have any sort of margin of safety.
It's Robin Farzad, host of Public Radio's Full Disclosure. Thank you.
My pleasure. Take care.
Well, in Washington today, lawmakers are expected to pass a bill that would give President Trump $1.4 billion for new fencing along the U.S.-Mexico border. But journalists working along the border are finding themselves subject to increased scrutiny by customs agents. Reporter Max Rivlin-Nadler has the story.
Ariana Dressler is a photojournalist based in San Diego. She began covering asylum seekers in Tijuana last spring. She crosses the border several times a week. And, starting in December, Every time she crossed back into the U.S., she was pulled into secondary. That's where agents take people aside for further questioning, sometimes for hours. Agents asked her about events taking place in Tijuana and the people working with asylum seekers.
That's not part of my job, to keep getting stopped by these guys and doing their homework for them.
Other journalists stopped at the border have said that agents have shown them photo lineups of individuals, asking them to help identify activists and other organizers that the agents described as instigating asylum seekers. This type of behavior is alarming, says Alexandra Ellerbeck. She's with the Committee to Protect Journalists. Her organization issued an urgent report last November about increasing incidents of CBP agents searching journalists' electronic devices and questioning them about their reporting and their sources. They've heard of at least a dozen journalists who have been questioned by CBP while crossing the border.
The ability for journalists to protect their sources, the ability for them to protect the information they gather in the course of the reporting, the ability for them to be seen as independent of law enforcement, not sort of another intelligence arm of the government, is so central to what journalism is.
In addition to journalists, volunteers working with asylum seekers and lawyers who advise them on their rights are also becoming increasingly wary of CBP searches. One attorney working with asylum seekers in Tijuana told NPR that last month, agents went through sensitive legal documents she was carrying. She asked to remain anonymous as her organization continues to work in Tijuana. Maria Chavez is an immigration lawyer based in San Diego. She's concerned about what's going on at the border.
Attorney-client privilege is huge, and if they have the right to go through our phones, through our laptops, if I take a case file with me and they want to make a copy of everything, that's definitely breaking attorney-client privilege.
At the same time that screenings of journalists and lawyers have ramped up, several have been barred from entering the country by Mexican authorities because of new alerts placed on their passports. Mexican officials have told them the alerts come from U.S. authorities. Nicole Ramos is a U.S. citizen and a lawyer with the organization Al Otro Lado, based in Tijuana. She had her expedited border crossing card confiscated by U.S. authorities last month and has since stayed in Mexico.
And it's not coincidental that these alertas were issued in conjunction with the rollout of MPP.
MPP is the Migrant Protection Protocols, a brand new policy that aims to keep asylum seekers in Mexico as their claim is processed. The Department of Homeland Security has stressed that asylum seekers would still have access to lawyers, but hasn't specifically spelled out how. CBP declined repeated requests for comment about specific cases where journalists and lawyers have been barred from entering Mexico. Meanwhile, Congress is growing interested. Senator Ron Wyden's office says the senator has reached out to CBP with questions about their scrutiny of reporters and activists at the border. For Here and Now, I'm Max Rivlin-Nadler in San Diego.
And a quick check-in now on a horrific story. The FBI has released 16 of convicted serial killer Samuel Little's drawings of some of the 90 women he now claims to have murdered. Little is already serving consecutive life sentences for three murders in the 1980s in Los Angeles. He's been working with investigators and drawing other women he claims to have killed decades ago, including in Georgia. Josh Sharp is with the Atlanta Journal-Constitution. Josh, how is this reverberating there?
Well, the response in Atlanta so far seems to be a bit muted, and that is because at this point no one knows, apparently even Sam Little doesn't know who these women he killed were. And also the killings were in the early 80s, so quite a very long time ago. So that's why these sketches hopefully can jog someone's memory to someone who may have died years ago.
Well, Little claimed seven murders in Georgia. Have any of those been connected to other murders?
Authorities have confirmed that they believe they've matched two of those, one in Dade County, Georgia, which is extreme northwest Georgia near the Tennessee border, and one in the Macon area, which is middle Georgia, which is not far from the tiny town where Sam Little's from.
And we understand they're working to confirm three in Atlanta and two in Savannah?
Correct.
Well, so far we know authorities have matched 34 of his confessions to killings he claims to have committed. But again, this doesn't mean that he definitely did it. If he did, he would be, perhaps the worst serial killer
in America. And now the officials are asking for help. And they're saying that in many cases, these pictures may be of women whose deaths were overlooked because they might have been prostitutes, drug addicts, and would not have been thought that they were murdered. It might have been thought they overdosed.
Exactly. And while the authorities say that some of the women that he killed were perhaps involved in drugs or prostitution, all of them don't seem to fit those criteria necessarily. There was an 18-year-old girl named Fredonia Smith whose parents said she simply went out for ice cream one day and never returned. This was in July of 1982, and her remains were found about a month later in someone's backyard. But for all this time, until Sam Little started making confessions recently, the case was cold.
FBI officials are hoping someone will identify some of these women. We'll post it at herenow.org. Josh Sharp with the Atlanta Journal-Constitution, thank you.
Thank you. Thank you very much.
Republicans in Washington are spending a lot of time these days attacking a plan by Congresswoman Alexandria Ocasio-Cortez to raise taxes on the super rich. Here she is explaining the idea to CBS's 60 Minutes.
Once you get to like the tippy tops on your 10 millionth dollar, sometimes you see tax rates as high as 60 or 70%.
That 70% tax rate came up again last month at the World Economic Forum in Davos, Switzerland, a conference filled with rich people. Panelists, including the billionaire founder of Dell Technologies, Michael Dell, and MIT economics professor Eric Brynjolfsson, were asked about the 70% proposal.
Michael Dell, do you support this?
I just want to say I'm thrilled that they're asking.
Wow. Well, look, I mean, you know, my wife and I set up a foundation about 20 years ago, and we would have contributed quite a bit more than a 70% tax rate on my income, on my annual income. And I feel much more comfortable with our ability as a private foundation to allocate those funds than I do giving them to the government.
All right.
So, no, I'm not supportive of that.
Well, Keith.
And I don't think it would help the growth of the U.S. economy.
Oh, that's interesting. And can you say a little bit more about why? Why you don't think it would?
Well, name a country where that's worked, ever.
United States.
Briefly, in the 80s.
Maybe. No. From about the 1930s through about the 1960s, the tax rate averaged about 70%. At times, it was up as high as 95%. And those were actually pretty good years.
That debate continued, and we'll post the video at hereandnow.org. But we're going to have a debate of our own right now with two economists who have different points of view. Chris Edwards is director of tax policy studies at the Cato Institute, a libertarian think tank in Washington. Chris, welcome.
Thanks for having me.
And Marshall Steinbaum is also with us, research director and fellow at the Roosevelt Institute, a progressive think tank. Welcome to you, Marshall.
Great to be here.
So what about this idea? Obviously, there is disagreement about this, but Marshall, is Eric Brynjolfsson right there that the U.S. had much higher tax rates and was able to have very good growth?
Yeah, he absolutely is. I think that exchange was quite revealing about the core issues at play when it comes to progressive tax policy. For one thing, the billionaire said, well, we can allocate the money better in my private foundation, which I have total control over, and I get to decide who benefits and who doesn't from the dispensation of my fortune. Or we can give it to the government, where democracy and the mechanisms of communal distribution are at play. So I think the core issue with progressive tax policy is who do we want making decisions in our economy, billionaires or democracy?
Chris, what do you think?
Well, I think that I would agree with what Michael Dell said in that exchange, that he can allocate his capital better. I think most very high earners in America, they don't have inherited wealth. They're very productive people. They're entrepreneurs and they're venture capitalists and they're brain surgeons and other very smart people. These people innovate and start companies and they create whole new industries. So I think people like, you know, from Sam Walton all the way through to Steve Jobs and many others benefit the rest of us enormously. We cannot go back to those high tax rates we had in the mid 20th century. Globalization has vastly changed the world economy. So United States is not the only country that cut its top income tax rate. The average rate across industrial countries fell from 68% in 1980 to just 43% today. Across all of Europe and Canada and Australia, everyone slashed their top tax rates because capital flows started going over borders and you couldn't contain wealthy people anymore. Countries realize it's in their own self-interest to have moderate tax rates at the top end and allow wealthy people to do what they do best, which is invest in the domestic economy.
What about that, Marshall, the idea that competitively the U.S. can't keep the rates that high if other countries aren't?
Yeah, I think we have seen, indeed, lots of countries cut tax rates on the top, and that's exactly why inequality has gone up so much. So we have experience cutting tax rates. The big question in the economy right now is, why are corporate profits so high while corporate investment is so low, despite the fact that we just had a gigantic corporate tax cut? The economic prediction behind enacting a policy like that is that it's supposed to induce the so-called productive people in the economy to invest and expand and the rest of us benefit thereby. And we know it didn't work this time. It hasn't worked any time for the last 40 years. And that's had disastrous consequences for everybody else.
Okay. This conversation could go on forever, but I do want to get to another part of this, which is what Alexandria Ocasio-Cortez is trying to tackle here, which is income inequality in this country. And we know that according to the National Bureau of Economic Research, the top 0.1% of people own almost as much wealth as the bottom 90% of people. Chris, what about that? How do you tackle income inequality without putting more tax on the rich?
Well, one thing I would say about that is that it's true there is a lot of income inequality, but the U.S. economy is very dynamic. So the IRS puts out data every year on the 400 richest people in the country with the highest incomes, and they track these people over time. Three-quarters of the people in the IRS top 400 every year change. So it's the U.S. economy is very dynamic. This is not inherited wealth we're talking about. It's dynamic because of all the entrepreneurship, because of all the new industries being created. The second thing I would say is there is income inequality created by government. So, for example, crony capitalism. The federal government spends $25 billion a year on farm subsidies. Those farm subsidies go to wealthy landowners. I would eliminate policies like that that benefit the wealthy. And then at the bottom end, the government does stuff that raises costs on low-income folks. It raises the cost of gasoline with ethanol mandates. It raises the cost of clothing and shoes with import tariffs. So I would try to get government out of the way when it itself is exacerbating inequality.
Marshall?
I think the fundamental debate that we're having here is a question about whether there exists a moral hierarchy of wealth. I think there's a tradition within the field of economics and in general public debate that the reason why good wealthy people are wealthy is because the government did not intervene. Instead, it allowed their brilliant ideas to take flight and incur the income and wealth that they merited in the free market. I mean, it makes sense in kind of economic theory, but it just so happens that that theory has nothing to do with reality.
I just want to ask each of you to tell me what you think, because we heard that number 70% in Alexandria Ocasio-Cortez's plan for the tax rate on people over $10 million. What do you think, Marshall, first of all, that the top tax rate should be on those people?
Yeah, 70 is not nearly high enough, and $10 million is much too high of a threshold for it to kick in.
So what should it be?
I think as Brynjolfsson said in that debate, we used to have a tax rate of 91% in this country on the top incomes. I think that kicked in at a threshold that would nowadays be in the neighborhood of, you know, mid six figures type of income. And that was when this country's economy grew the fastest. And I think we now know that the economy did much better back when the top marginal tax rate was 91%.
Okay, and Chris, what are your thoughts on what the top rate should be on the wealthiest Americans?
Well, it should be much lower. It should be as low as we can get. It's not reality. We're not going to go back up to a 70% tax rate. What would happen if we tried to raise our rate that high is you'd get massive tax avoidance and evasion. Also, even if you tried to do that, the federal government would hardly raise any money. I mean, European governments are bigger than the U.S. government, but how do they finance it? The only way you can finance is it by having a mass tax on the middle class. In Europe, it is called a value-added tax. It's 20% on average on everything people buy, clothing and food and automobiles, etc., are all taxed. at that 20% in Europe. So if folks like Alexandria Ocasio-Cortez and Elizabeth Warren want a bigger government, ultimately it's going to be a mass tax on the middle class that funds it.
Okay, so we've heard what each of you have to say. I wonder, though, when each of you hear that and hear what the other side says, you almost couldn't be further apart from each other. And I guess that tells us a little bit about this country right now. There are a lot of people who would agree with each one of you.
No, I think that's right. There is a large sort of partisan and ideological division in the country, and I don't know what to do with it. I think we do have to look at the experience of other countries. We have to adopt the best practices we see abroad. And from my point of view, it's pretty clear that the best practice around the world these days is to go to lower, flatter tax systems. If the government wants to raise more money, and I'm not in favor of that, but they would have to go to some broad sales tax or value-added tax. You're not going to get any more money out of hiking taxes on high-income folks, nor would you want to, because I do think that would damage the economy. Entrepreneurs would leave the United States. There would be less investment, and that would hurt everybody, and not just high-income folks.
Marshall?
I actually think it's not correct that progressive tax policy is a polarizing issue. I think it actually offers a way of bringing this country together. That some new polling data released from Data for Progress shows that Alexandria Ocasio-Cortez's proposal and Elizabeth Warren's proposal actually get the vast majority of support and even a plurality of support among Republicans. So I think there is a lot of political polarization in this country. If we want to end it, the best way to do that would be to enact a confiscatory progressive tax regime.
Okay, we'll leave it there. Chris Edwards, who is Director of Tax Policy Studies at the Cato Institute, a libertarian think tank in Washington, and Marshall Steinbaum, who is a Research Director and Fellow at the Roosevelt Institute. That's a progressive think tank. Thanks to both of you for joining us.
Thank you very much.
Thanks for having me.
Here and Now is supported by LegalZoom, who wants you to know that if you want to make 2019 the year you finally start a business or secure your family's future, LegalZoom can help. With their network of independent attorneys licensed in all 50 states, LegalZoom can help you navigate your legal needs from wills and trusts to LLCs, trademarks, contract reviews, and more. And the best part is, LegalZoom is not a law firm, so they don't charge by the hour. More at LegalZoom.com/now.
Colorado Governor Jared Polis is congratulating Denver teachers for ending a three-day strike, saying that Denver's kids are the biggest winners in a tentative deal that was reached overnight. The teachers' union and the Denver School District agreed to pay raises of up to 11% next year with built-in cost-of-living increases. Some teachers returned to their jobs today. The strike in Denver was part of a wave of teacher activism that began last year when teachers in Arizona, Oklahoma, and West Virginia walked off their jobs. Joining us now is Jenny Brundine, education reporter for Colorado Public Radio. Jenny, you were up all night covering this agreement in Denver. Is it fair to say both sides compromised?
Yes, it is fair to say both sides compromised, though I do think the district moved quite a bit considerably towards the union's proposal. But yes, they compromised in the sense that the union really wanted much higher base salary. Denver has one of the lowest competitive wages, I should say, in the nation. And they got that. On the other hand, the district was very intent upon maintaining incentives for a set of schools that are very high poverty and have really struggled academically. They believe those incentives allow teachers, help teachers stay there, help retain teachers. The union disagrees with that philosophy, but in the end, they agreed to keep those incentives.
Well, teachers said that the current merit compensation system, which was once hailed as a national model and embraced by the teachers' union, has been broken for years. Explain that. Why did they think that?
Yeah, there were about 10 to 12 incentives to start. I mean, everything from being in a high-poverty school, being in a hard-to-fill position like math. But what happened is eventually those incentives changed over time. And I'll give you an example. Let's say a neighbor, you're in a Title I school and you're getting that Title I incentive. That means a high-poverty incentive. But then your neighborhood gentrifies, and there's slightly more affluent students there, you would lose that incentive. Mm-hmm. Other examples like that, teachers found that those incentives were fluctuating, they were unreliable and unpredictable. I talked to about 40 teachers one day, and not one of them could tell me how much money they were making. So it was very confusing and broken. And the district even agreed that that was the case, and that you know, helped in the negotiations.
Well, is the underlying issue here in Denver that this is a city that is growing very fast, that it is getting more expensive, and that the teacher contract is just hasn't kept up with what's happening on the ground in Denver?
That's exactly right. It was almost the perfect storm, a confluence of issues. Housing prices here have just absolutely skyrocketed. And we're also in a state that is pretty much near the bottom. And we're in a little bit of an unusual situation. Colorado is the only state where the legislature cannot raise taxes. And every time a ballot measure to raise money for public education has gone before voters, it's turned down. So currently, Denver has lost, or I should say the state has withheld nearly $750 million from Denver public schools. It's a very complicated issue, but that's feeding into all of the chronic underfunding that you see in many cities. But yes, you're right. The housing prices certainly added to this strike.
That is Jenny Brundine, education reporter with Colorado Public Radio. Thanks so much, Jenny.
Thank you.
And you're listening to Here and Now.
And on Valentine's Day, many of us reach for poetry. Maybe it's Mary Oliver, who we lost this year. What a loss. Maybe it's Rumi, or maybe it's Sarah Kay, an award-winning poet and contributor to Poetry RX, a column where readers write in with emotional conundrums and three resident poets sort of write a prescription for the perfect poem to carry them through. It's published every week by the Paris Review. We'll link you at hereandnow.org as we convene a special radio edition of Poetry RX with pharmacist, poet Sarah Kay. Hi, Sarah.
Hi.
You know, I'm reading through, and most of the things that you respond to are problems, but we are going to ask you for, you know, the love that maybe isn't as problematic. But what is the goal here? It's not to fix the problem, right?
No. I have a phrase that I say a lot, which is, I don't think poetry will save us, and yet. And I think it's the and yet part.
We hope. But in the meantime, if it doesn't save us, it offers balm, living with the problem in a more loving way. Let's start. Here's a letter from someone very much in love but with complicated feelings. They write, "Dear Poets," that's how they address the column, "I'm in love in a way I've never experienced before. I've always kept a safe distance from my relationships, but now I feel vulnerable for the first time." And they go on to say, "Is there a poem out there for this feeling? Because I'm emotionally dependent on him, and it makes me anxious and a little scared." What'd you say?
Well, for this particular person, I said, "I'm delighted to share with you a poem by one of my favorite poets, Natalie Diaz. And the poem is called When the Beloved Asks, What Would You Do If You Woke Up and I Was a Shark?" That's the name of the poem. And there's this one section in particular that I love, in which she says, "I wouldn't fight, not kick, flail, not carry on like one driven mad by the black neoprene wetsuit of death, not like sad-mouthed, despair-eyed albacore, nor blubbery pinnipeds, nor slug my ferocious, streamlined lover's titanium white nose, that bullseye of cartilage. No, I wouldn't prolong it. Instead, I'd place my head onto that dark altar of jaws, prostrated pilgrim at Melville's glittering gates, climb into that mysterious window starred with teeth, the one lit room in the charnel house."
In other words, go for it.
Yeah.
Go for it.
Yeah.
Wow. You know, this is not, you know, roses are red, violets are blue.
not even close.
No. What about somebody feeling alone? Here's another letter writer. "Dear Poets, I'm feeling quite lonely this week. I'm wondering if you knew of a poem that both acknowledges that sadness but isn't consumed by it. I'm feeling very swallowed up in my loneliness, and I need a nice poetry life preserver."
So for this person, a lot of people write in about loneliness, but I really liked that this person specifically requested a poem that acknowledges sadness without being consumed by it. And so I recommended a poem by Jose Olivares from his new book, Citizen Illegal. And the poem is called Not Love is a Season. Mm-hmm. And the poem starts, "Not love is a season. I drank fire. A dozen blankets couldn't keep me from shivering. Winter is an unavoidable fact, unless you're from Cali, and I don't trust people who don't know the freeze of loneliness. The dead branches abandoned by the birds still chasing summer. My homies all telling me I'll meet someone else, like I want to meet someone else. My wound deep, but mine. Already time working to ease my grip on my hurt. I know misery thaws.
Not love is a season, it'll pass.
Yeah, I think that, you know, there's a lot of different metaphors you could use for heartbreak. You know, a hole you're trying to climb out of. But a hole is difficult to escape and can seem impossible. But a season must arrive. And Jose says winter is an unavoidable fact. And it also must pass. That is what seasons do. And so if your loneliness is here, it also means it will not be here forever. And it's okay to acknowledge it and even maybe to relish in it a little bit. But I'm hoping that this person allows room for thawing.
For thawing. And again, these are people with predicaments on this day. And I sometimes think they outnumber those who just kind of glide through it. So let's keep going with somebody who wanted to rekindle an old fling. It didn't work. She writes, after a long separation, I spontaneously invited an ex-fling to join me on a trip. It didn't go well. He was disinterested. He was boorish. Skipping ahead in her letter, she says it was more like babysitting a sullen teen. I had some long lingering feelings and hopes about us as a pair. I'm over it now. I'm not heartbroken, but I still feel like I'm mourning the end of a long fantasy now. Do you have a poem for this?
Yeah. So everyone signs their letter with a pen name, mm-hmm. anonymously. And so this person signed their letter, Sincerely Wrong Girl. And I really wanted her to know that I didn't think she was the wrong girl. It was that she's the right girl, but with the wrong guy. Mm-hmm. And I said, actually, more specifically, you're the right girl who has fallen for the age-old trick of falling for the fantasy guy, but winding up with the actual guy who, as it turns out, you might not actually like that much.
All in caps.
Yeah. And so there's this poem by Muriel Rukeyser called Waiting for Icarus. And the whole poem is amazing, but the beginning of the poem is, he said he would be back and we'd drink wine together. He said that everything would be better than before. He said we were on the edge of a new relation. He said he loved me, that going into me. He said he was going into the world and the sky. He said all the buckles were very firm. He said the wax was the best wax.
Icarus.
Yeah. And I love this poem because, first of all, it suggests that women have been falling for the myth of men in lieu of the real man in front of us since, mythical times. And it's easy to get swept up in the stories we tell ourselves about people, especially when they're far away. And the end of the poem goes, I remember the girls laughing. I remember they said he only wanted to get away from me. I remember my mother saying, inventors are like poets, a trashy lot. I remember she told me, those who try out inventions are worse. I remember she added, women who love such are the worst of all. I have been waiting all day, or perhaps longer. I would have liked to try those wings myself. It would have been better than this.
And we remember Icarus, the son of Daedalus, the mythological figures. Daedalus made wings out of wax and feathers for himself and his son, and he told his son, don't fly too close to the sun. But Icarus did, of course, the wings melted. And I love that. He said the wax was the best wax. But no, he flew too close to the sun. So, Sarah Kay, let's not leave with that image of, you know, wings melting and Icarus plummeting from the sky and disappointing yet another young woman. Can you have some poems for us that are just straight ahead, you know, we're in love and at least for this day, problem free?
Yeah. I have a poem called Here and Now. Ooh. That goes, here and now, I have only these hands, this mouth, this skin as wide as a shoreline, this beehive between my ears, this buzz. You are the best thing I never planned. This is the widest I can stretch my arms without dropping things. This is the first time I don't care if I drop things. This is what dropping things feels like. This is what happens when the flowers wake up one morning and decide to smell human. It confuses us, makes us reach backwards into places that are sharp, feel around for things we've dropped. I have forgotten what I was looking for. It doesn't seem important. You brought me flowers. You made the bed. This is the widest I can stretch my arms. This is all I have right now.
Oh, here and now. Well, and listeners, if you steal it for this evening, please credit Sarah Kay. Sarah Kay, the award-winning poet and contributor to Poetry RX, the column in which readers write in with an emotional problem and resident poets prescribe a poem. We'll link you up at hereandnow.org if you want to do it. But meantime, Sarah Kay, thank you so much.
Thank you.
Again, Poetry RX, published weekly by the award-winning literary quarterly, The Paris Review. Check it out. While at hereandnow.org, listen to another of Sarah Kay's love poems, Love Letter from the Toothbrush to the Bicycle Tire. You're welcome. It is great. And let us know your Valentine's Day poem picks. Help someone else out.
Sometime between now and April 1st, Russia will disconnect itself from the global internet for a few hours. The country said it plans to sign off as part of an exercise to gauge how well it could withstand a cyber attack that originates outside Russia. Critics also say it's another step toward creating a surveillance state. Ben Brock Johnson covers tech for Here and Now. Hi, Ben.
Hi, Jeremy.
So what does this mean that they would disconnect Russia from the internet?
Okay, so the bad news is I'm not a network systems administrator, Jeremy, and I'm not Sir Tim Berners-Lee who invented the internet. So I don't know the technical parts of this. I couldn't do it for you if you wanted me to. Mm-hmm. But basically, the way this works is a lot of the information we access as we go about our day isn't a direct line that exists inside our own country, right? We might access information that's for the user actually in Germany or in Canada or somewhere. And Russia's the same way. When a user goes to get information online, that information may not be stored in Russia. So the idea here is to make sure that it is all stored in Russia or that their systems are hard enough for accessing the internet that users can access information online should there be a disruption like this.
And why do they say that they're doing this?
So this is part of a law that has been drafted there called the Digital Economy National Program. And Russia says that this is about making sure an effort to isolate the country by cutting it off from the internet won't actually cut it off from the internet. It essentially a defense against some kind of potential outside attack. But there are two reasons for this happening, Jeremy, as you might, you know, assume. It is about internal control as much as it is protection from an external attack.
Protection from an external attack. But Russia has been, as we know, the one that often launches the cyber attack. But they're worried here that the roles would reverse and they would be attacked.
Yeah. And, you know, I guess in fairness, one could say, sanctions and other efforts of influence on the global stage often involve the internet. So you could imagine this scenario playing out. I think these types of situations often see state actors fighting fire with fire. You might remember the so-called malicious computer worm Stuxnet, which almost a decade ago now crippled nuclear facilities in Iran. It's believed that that was a cyber weapon developed at least in part by the U.S. So there is kind of a back and forth that happens here. And
It also makes you think, though, that Russia could be getting closer to the China model. And if you go to China right now and you try to open up Google or you try to open up Facebook, you can't do it. They've got control over the internet there. Is that part of this, too, that Russia is able to say, we're the ones in control of whether the internet is on or off and what you can look at and what you can't?
I think that's definitely right. And that's what we're seeing here effectively is Russia trying to recreate that inside Russia. So I actually reached out to a journalist and author working in Moscow. His name is Andrei Soldatov, and he wrote a book called The Red Web. And he says this is definitely a concern. He gave this recent example. So the Republic of Ingushetia, which is part of the Russian Federation, last October, thousands of people were actually protesting there. They were protesting a border deal between Russia and Chechnya. And mobile internet in this area, which was a tool for protesters, was cut at the request of secret services, reportedly. So, yes, this is surely about Russia trying to develop systems of control over communication inside the country.
Does the U.S. have the ability to do something like this, to shut the internet down for a period of time?
So this is a good question. While we are developing more aggressive tools of attack all the time, I think, and I, you know, think have been for some time, along with tools of hardening our own systems just against other kinds of disruptions, both in terms of the non-consumer internet, so think power plants and other infrastructure that could be vulnerable, figuring out ways of cutting off those really mission-critical parts of our infrastructure from internet disruptions that might happen. I think the U.S. continues to be a place where the ideal is to not create these kinds of digital borders, right? The World Wide Web, as we know it, is supposed to be worldwide, and everybody is supposed to be connected to each other. And I think U.S. tech companies, as well as the U.S. government, depending on certain circumstances that you're talking about, isn't really trying to figure out a way to like flip a switch and disconnect the U.S. from the internet elsewhere in the world.
Well, that's kind of nice to hear.
We can hope. We can hope for sure.
That is Ben Brock Johnson, who covers tech for Here and Now. Ben, thank you.
Thank you.
Well, we're tracking the torrential rain that's falling across much of California today. You can blame it on the atmospheric river that's funneling moisture from the tropics near Hawaii across the Pacific. Flooding, mudslides, and debris flows are hitting Northern California hard. Early this morning, a woman was rescued from her house after a mudslide ripped the home off its foundation in Sausalito. Southern Marin Fire Captain Doug Peterson described the rescue on the local NBC affiliate.
Surprisingly, we could see a hand through some of the debris. So we knew where she was. She was screaming for help. So we were fortunate in that we could find her right away.
Areas that burned in recent wildfires are particularly vulnerable to flooding. We're going to be keeping a close eye on this story. Robin, I was just in Southern California recently. These houses are not built for this kind of rain. They were all leaking
How
water.
How amazing, though. They saw her hand.
Yeah.
Amazing.
Good that they got her.
Yeah.
Here and Now is a production of NPR and WBUR in association with the BBC World Service. I'm Jeremy Hobson.
I'm Robin Young. It's Here and Now.